Welcome to a no-holds-barred episode of the Agotat Show, where the only thing off-limits is a dull moment. Today, we're shaking up the TV measurement scene with Kevin Krim, CEO of EDO. Forget about your grandma's TV ratings. We're diving deep into the data-driven revolution that's turning heads and flipping tables. Hold on to your mortgage bill, because we're about to find out how EDO is giving the ad world the facelift it didn't know it desperately needed, and no more than you did yesterday.
Deserve to win when it matters most. Facing multi-billion dollar bet the company litigation? No problem. That's why we're here. Troutman Amin, LLP, is a true legal powerhouse.
Hi, this is Pesach Latin and the Adotit Show. I am here with Kevin Krim, the CEO of EDO. We were talking before we started recording what EDO means. But anyways, when did you take one look at the TV measurement tactics and think, This mess needs a new facelift stat? What was the spark for EDO's big bang, aside from the obvious industry snooze fest?
Yeah, thanks for being here. Thanks for having me here. And
thank you also.
I think a lot of it came from this combination of where the various founding team came from, and I'd spent the first half of my career as an advertising product manager doing early search ads and social ads at places like LookSmart and LiveJournal and then at Yahoo. And then I switched careers sort of and moved out to New York and helped build out digital media products and businesses, first at Bloomberg Media and then at CNBC. And it was those seminal years of the first mobile apps on iOS. The first OTT streaming apps. I mean, I remember the Roku team, Anthony Wood and his crew coming into Bloomberg's headquarters and bringing this little puck with them and saying, hey, we can plug this into the TV and we can start streaming television through it. And Bloomberg TV didn't have any cable carriage contracts that restricted our freedom, so we were able to be the first streaming TV channel on Roku. It really struck me how different the pricing and measurement was for between sort of these natively digital advertising ecosystems like search or social and then traditional TV. And in one case, in these natively digital kind of systems, you had really an idea from the get-go of automatic optimization towards outcomes, that the whole pricing system was predicated on, if you can drive better engagement with the ad, you're also going to drive higher prices and therefore higher yield for the owners of the inventory. It was a very virtuous cycle. And then you had this weird thing with TV where you're pricing on only a portion of the audience, this demographic kind of subset of the whole audience who's watching, and you're basically saying, I will guarantee to deliver this percentage or this number of this demographic audience. If I fail to, I owe you back money. If I exceed that level, I don't get paid any more money. And it just felt like that's not going to be the way it is. That's not the way we'll want it to be when it's a streaming first television delivery mechanism. And that seemed inevitable as we're launching these early OTT apps. And that was, over 10 years ago now. And then met some, co-founders. Edward Norton's one of our co-founders. He's our chairman. And Edward was talking about how the inefficiencies of movie marketing was hurting what creators like he and his friends like Wes Anderson, they were right. Just coming off of, off of some really great movies, and they weren't being able to make as much as what they wanted to make because of the inefficiencies of how much money was being spent and in their view wasted on TV marketing of their films. And so he was driving for a data science first platform for understanding what's working and what's not to drive out efficiencies in marketing. And so that was his sort of call to action for us and EDO. Here we are. You know, it's been over 9 years, and you know, now it is a streaming first ecosystem. It wasn't when we got started, but you know, that has changed basically everything about what the buyers and the sellers need in this marketplace, and we're serving both.
If traditional metrics are dinosaurs, what is EDO's meteor strike?
It's, you know, I don't know if they're dinosaurs, but I will say what our meteor strike is. I like that. I like that idea, that image. You know, what we're disrupting in this marketplace, what we're doing that really unsettles people, is we are kind of collapsing these false dichotomies of there's brand marketing and there's performance marketing. It's all one thing. Every time a 21st century consumer is exposed to an ad,
right,
you are getting a brand effect and an outcome effect all at once. And so the things that we're shaking up the most are these ideas that the right way to measure brand advertising is through these really old school, very blunt force ways of doing survey questions, asking people to try to remember if they were watching a certain program and if they remember seeing a certain ad, and then
your feeling about the brand? How do you feel about the brand now?
Right.
I have to be honest. Yeah. When I've answered those, I was like, you're annoying me. I feel nothing about the brand right now.
Right.
And who has time to sit through the Nielsen packet?
Right. And it's,
I don't think I'm ever going to get Nielsen as a client, as a guest now, but
it's a, I think they understand. I mean, I think anyone who's fundamentally relying on small samples of people in a highly complex environment like streaming television, they know, first of all, there's a ton of sample bias, and there's going to be huge sparsity issues when it comes to coverage of what you can really drill down to and what you can really do with it. So, that's problem number one that these old methodologies suffer from. Problem number two, which is very insidious, is projection bias. That when you ask consumers about how they are going to act in the future, the consumers don't really know. More importantly, they
feel they have to do something. There's not D, I really want not to answer this question, or do nothing.
Yeah, and the reality is you project this ego-driven, like, image of yourself out to the world when you're responding to these things. And, you know, if you listen to these surveys, literally, everyone listens to, NPR.
Right.
And they're all going to exercise more, and they're all going to eat better, and they're all going to drink less, and all those things, and they don't.
Right. we all know that consumers
predicated on them lying to themselves.
I mean, I hate to say this, but consumers really don't know what they want or what they're going to do. I mean, that's part of, I hate to say that, but it's part of the job of advertising is to often, you know, just solve the problems of consumers, but to really tell them what they want. I know it sounds,
interesting, and there's a lot of wisdom in the old merchant's adage of, you know, don't read their lips, read their feet.
Right.
The old merchant, you know, the retailer,
where they buy.
You know, watch the foot traffic. Like, literally watch where they walk through your store. That's going to tell you what you can sell to them, right? And in the 21st century context, it's watch their fingers as they are engaging in digital ways with brands and products, right? And what we see is there's this near Pavlovian response mechanism as people are exposed to ads, where they start doing stuff. They start grabbing their phone or other connected device, and they start searching. They go to websites, they go to apps, and those are incredibly powerful signals of consideration and intent. And it's those signals that, if you automate at a huge scale, a system of understanding who's been exposed to ads and who has not been exposed to ads, and then you look at the differential lift in those kinds of behaviors, of exposed or unexposed, you can start to really understand with predictive confidence what is the efficacy of different ad tactics, what creatives are working best in which for which audience segments, which media buys, are worth the exit, you know, the premium, which ones aren't. All of those decisions, which are fundamentally what we're all trying to achieve when we're planning out a brand campaign, you finally right. have decision-worthy data at your fingertips that says, I can predict with like, you know, a band of 10%, you know, confidence, a variance within that band. I know that this is what I'm going to get when I buy this.
When you first pitched this, what was the reaction? Did jaws hit the floor, or were people just too stunned to laugh?
It was like suggesting that somebody should try a peanut butter and tuna fish sandwich. That's what it was.
Yeah.
I'm not joking. People, you get this kind of perplexed view, and then you get this kind of angry response.
You mentioned people were disturbed. I thought that was interesting. Yeah. I think that's the word you use.
No, it's like peanut butter is only disrupted.
They were disturbed.
Yeah, peanut butter is only supposed to go with you know, jelly. Like that's just right. You know. And yeah,
I'm still not trying the peanut butter and tuna.
Yeah. But actually what we're offering is peanut butter and pickles, which is delicious, and it's really yeah. worth it. Elvis was onto something when he talked about those sandwiches. But
I just know the banana and peanut butter. I don't know about yeah. the peanut butter and pickles.
Peanut butter and pickles, delicious. It was an Elvis favorite, worth trying. Uh-huh. So that's a service to your listeners out there. But you know what was really happening, why there was that anger was I've built a career, frankly, and a whole, you know, sort of paradigm around I do brand marketing over here in this container, and I do performance marketing in this other container, and I, you know, have upper funnel things and I have lower funnel things, and what we were lighting up, we were putting this bright spotlight on, is those were all false dichotomies.
When did you realize you were sitting on a gold mine? Like, what was that old snap moment? You're like, oh, this is going to work. This is a gold mine. I'm not moving back to, where were you from, LA?
I was originally from LA. And okay. I was at that point in New York. And yeah, there was that question, when do I have to move back? I actually, you know, I'm one of those people who's, New York's deeply under my skin. So there's no leave.
Yeah, I'm still a few years out, and I still feel it.
Yeah, yeah. You're in New Mexico now?
Yeah, is that I am. Yeah. Yeah, I had a kid. No, I'm actually in Arizona. I lived in New Mexico for a few
years.
Right.
Sorry. Love the Southwest. Okay, so the aha moment was our first proof of concept was actually building a box office prediction software platform for movies.
Right.
We thought if we can prove that, you know, with super high confidence, we can generate better box office predictions off these behavioral signals, then that's going to be the best proof of concept we can have for marketers. And the movies are just a very discrete outcome, right? It's very clear. You either got the opening weekend box office or you didn't. And there's lots of historical comparables to work off of. And so it was an elegant place to start. And what happened was we only had sort of daily granularity of signal back then. And you'd see the first trailer drop, and obviously you'd see these huge spikes in engagement signals for the trailer drop. But then it would settle back down to some baseline. And then you'd see another spike, and our team would say, what was that? We talked to our client, early, like sort of beta clients. They said, oh, well, we ran an ad last night on Sunday Night Football or on, you know, the opening ceremony of the Olympics or whatever it was, right? It was some big event on TV. And we said, oh, that's interesting, right? A single ad airing on some big TV, we can see this big spike, even if it's only a one day of data. So we started challenging ourselves to get the data more granular, get down to minute by minute granularity of searches and web visits, and then automatically tie that to ad arians at a, you know, at a timestamp level that's super accurate. And we started seeing these spikes all over the place, not just on right. big TV, but on little TV, on regular average TV shows. You started seeing these spikes, not just for like a new movie or a new car where it's kind of intuitively going to generate a lot of this behavior, but you started seeing it on, you know, everyday products. We were asked by NBC in 2016, before the Summer Olympics started, hey, could you please measure the impact of every ad airing we have in the opening ceremonies of the Rio Olympics? And, you know, that got us thinking, okay, huh, well, you know, why would people search for a Coke when they see an ad in you know, the Olympics for Coca-Cola? And that's why I call it a Pavlovian response.
They actually went online and said, I want to know about the different Coca-Cola products.
Yeah, you know, it's look up the ingredients, or it's like, hey, is there some deal somewhere, you know, for a case? Right. Can I find a coupon for it? It's all over the map of, like, what are those specific
just seeing terms? The brand got them, again, got Pavlovian them response.
And
I really
did. Yeah, the percentage of respondents is lower for some category of product like that than it is for some category where there's high consideration and there's novel new products. But you know, when you're doing this apples to apples, you start to pick up incredibly powerful signals. And that's what we were fundamentally doing. And there was a lot of, you know, trial and error where we had to figure out, well, what are the exogenous factors that influence the size of these responses, these engagement rates, so we can really isolate what's signal and what's just noise. So that took a ton of time. It's true AI models behind this, because we're doing this at a scale that's staggering. There's no human intervention between us and measuring every single ad airing on all of TV. We've been doing it since the beginning of 2015. And now we do it also for all of streaming. And what happened with streaming is that you don't get these time-based spikes because all the ad impressions are delivered, you know, in a very dispersed on-demand way, right? So it's asynchronous consumption. And so then you have to look at samples of people or households, and you got to really understand on a one-to-one level, how are their behaviors changing versus, you know, when they're exposed or unexposed. And it's the same fundamental concept, but the technology is that much harder.
And I want to talk a little bit about about your Nielsen, the EDO Nielsen buddy cop movie. Your PR team maybe made it clear you guys are playing well together, but how do you guys play nice and still manage to dazzle the ad world with your double act?
Yeah, it is a really good partnership. And it's driven by the complementary aspect of what we do and what they do. I mean, they are an audience measurement company, and we don't do audience measurement. We view audience measurement as absolutely essential to what we do, but we are focused entirely, laser focused on outcome measurement. So what the buyers and the sellers want is both those things, and they want to make it easier to take these complex data sets and marry them at a true sort of atomic level, you know, marry these data sets at the row level for individual households in a privacy safe way, so that you can understand for a given audience segment, what are going to be the outcomes that are best, you know, are the best value for a buyer, or the best, you know, combination of outcomes from a seller's perspective, so they can justify, you know, the right pricing on their inventory.
How did that pitch look to Nielsen?
You know, it was organic. I had met Karthik Rao and Deirdre Thomas through various industry things, and it took, I'd say, the better part of a year to get to the point where we saw the vision and, you know, we're able to get the details lined up so that we could announce it. The demand from customers was really what drove us. I remember being with Deirdre at a conference, and one of the heads of one of the research groups, data groups at one of the major agency holding companies, you know, we were just chatting, the three of us, and I said, what's the single most important thing you need from us to use EDO or Nielsen more? And he said, I need your data sets to work together in a planning tool like Nielsen's Media Impact tool. And he said those words verbatim. And I just said, well, there's our business case, you know, to Deirdre, and we worked it out. It's technically complex. You know, anytime you're marrying data sets, you've got to deal with issues of identity, which is privacy, which is security. You've got combinations of our syndicated data sets that EDO and Nielsen each gather ourselves. But then you also, clients want to overlay their first party data, which adds, again, huge complexity of privacy and security. You want to keep those data sets discrete, separate from and secure from other data sets so that there's no confusion over the provenance of the data. And then you've got to find the novel applications of two data sets that have not historically sat together. And that's where we're excited about this idea of engaged reach. There's a bunch of branches underneath that concept of how you can express, here's the optimal way to reach the audience I'm trying to reach, with frequency as one of the sort of variables that is really important, for both value and performance. I have cost constraints, I have timing, what's my optimal outcome within those constraints? And that's what we can do together that the industry has never seen before.
What do you think is the big, and did you slay any dragon?
I would go back to, you know, this idea that attitudinal measurement is the end all be all. I'll give you an anecdote that's worth mentioning. I'm not going to name the brand, but I'm going to give you some clues. So, the category is insurance. And one of the brands that's not working with us, said, we're convinced that the ads we're running right now are exactly the right ads we need to run because the creatives that we're running right now are the exact creatives we need to run because our brand recall goes up when we run these ads a lot.
Right.
And I said, wait, so the measurement is you ask people, do you remember seeing an ad from your brand? And they say, yes. And they say, there's a little jingle that
people can even I can remember that, but I still use Geico. I can remember Liberty and Allstate. I can remember all their stuff, but I use Geico. It's not because of the Gecko.
That's right. And so, you know, that is the object lesson in the limits of your measurement should not influence your strategy. And yet you see it all the time that, you know, back in the day, you didn't have any other choice than to ask people survey questions. There was no way to see their actual behaviors, right? But when you confuse what you can do at the moment for the goal, you've lost the game already, right? The goal is not to be able to repeat a jingle back. The goal is to write more policies and take a higher share of a big marketplace. And to do
and they
it,
couldn't, they couldn't put that together. They had no.
The incentives are, I mean, it was, it gets so ingrained where you go from, okay, well, these are the limits of what we can measure. So therefore that's how we set our goals. And then the goals become incentives, literally compensation. And then that just perpetuates year in and year out where it's totally ingrained in the culture, the corporate culture. Those things are incredibly hard to get out of the DNA once they're in it. Right. And so, yeah, you have disruptors like Geico or Progressive who, you know, come in and say, we can approach this in a much more, you know, modern way. We can spend a ton of money on marketing, but that marketing has very direct impact on our business. We see the results as we spend.
Right.
Right. And our goal is not recall. Our goal is market share, profitable market share. Right. And then, you know, I think the fascinating example in that industry of someone who's taken a different approach, but one that is very appropriate to their business and is kicking butt, would be State Farm, where you've got State Farm who, unlike these direct-to-consumer models that Geico and Progressive had, State Farm has the country's largest army of agents. They have 19,000 agents that live in communities that are basically, you know, individual proprietors of their businesses, and they're aligned very closely with State Farm. And for State Farm, they have to do they have a different set of stakeholders, but they don't confuse what's possible to measure with what the goals are. They know that the goals are insurance policies profitably written, but they got to do it through their agents. So their whole brand approach is, you know, Jake from State Farm, like a good neighbor, and yet they use celebrity. They use sports incredibly well, and they look at a behavioral outcome like search engagement, like web visits, app usage.
And they're your client?
They're a client, yes. And, okay. and you know, A number of others in the industry are as well. And you know, so you don't have, there's not a one size fits all here. I'm citing like two very different strategic approaches, but where they're using data, and particularly behavioral data, very effectively in understanding what works for them. And it's all about know what works. It's not about like saying, I have a plan of, you know, I have some ingrained, written in stone plan that this is the only right way to do it, whether it's insurance or automotive or entertainment. That's not what it is. It's all about learn from what's working, do more of that, less of what's not. That's like, so that's the only philosophical thing I bring into any conversation. But, you know, to me, it's always, I just know it's going to be a problem when you're slaying, you know, you've got the dragon sitting there of people have confused what's they confuse the limits of the measurement with the goals, and it becomes, you know, a losing argument, a circular firing squad, if you will.
You have partnerships with Netflix's Forge Path to Victory.
I mean, you know, I love all my clients. Though I'm really proud of those clients because they represent, you know, technology first organizations that are really product driven. That aligns with our culture at EDO a lot. And they're the newest entrants into the advertising marketplace, really, right? And so you're not working, you're working from not greenfield, but you're working from, you know, somewhat blank slates where you can really innovate. With Netflix, they took one of the more aggressive, conservative privacy stances of anybody in the industry. Very, very good for their subscriber base, but it makes it very hard to impossible to apply any conventional methods or techniques to matching ad occurrence to behavioral outcomes. And so we had to innovate just to launch with Netflix ads. We had to innovate a whole new approach to how we measure the impact of these ads. And what we did is it's called micro cohorting. It's a known technique among academics who study like differential privacy as a topic, but it had never been built before in a production automated way at scale. And we had to do that, first time ever that we know of in the world that it was done. And we had to do that because we had no other choice to serve the needs of somebody like Netflix. So that kind of thing, we love that challenge. Super proud of it. It just builds up. It builds off of a great culture here at EDO where we find a way or make one. We do not settle for how things have always been done. We're always questioning. We're very curious. We're always wondering, can we do it differently and better? And
what do you think Netflix's biggest challenge is to serve ads?
Well, I think, you know, they set a very ambitious goal of getting that launched on a timeline. So they don't own all of
them. And fired a few people.
Right. It's you know, never a smooth and direct, you know, straight line.
Right.
But
it wasn't that. It was not terribly smooth.
Right. Well, but I think they're getting there. You know, it's a very much a product organization. So, you know, early decisions that had to necessary decisions that had to be done to get something out on a timeline. They learn from those. A culture like that learns from those. Are constantly iterating towards a better. Situation. They don't own all of their own tech stack yet. So I think, you know, that also is something that they will have to, you know, keep evolving. I don't pretend to know all the plans by any means, but you know, a culture like that, you think you would never bet against them. They've certainly figured out how to grow the subscriber base because of the Brit crackdown on account sharing and shared passwords. And so, you know, that's just one of many levers they have, I think, to do well. Same with Amazon, same with, you know, great organizations like Disney and NBC Universal. I wouldn't count them out. Their strengths are different, right? But they, you know, they are great at great, beautiful entertainment that people want to watch and enjoy. And so, you know, each has their strengths and they got to play to it.
If I was going to use EDO's tech to look behind the streaming curtain, what's a scoop that surprised you on viewer habits?
Well, you know, I'd say the biggest thing is that ad load, defined as how many minutes of advertising per hour of programming do you have to consume. Ad load is a big lever. So lower ad load, it's not shocking, but the data is very clear. Lower ad loads generate more engagement with the ads that are in those minutes of advertising.
So are we still doing these spots instead of things like, let me think off the hand, we could skin the Disney app, for example. So why aren't we being more creative? We're still doing these 15, 30 minutes, spots. 30 seconds, sorry.
I think some of those innovations are happening. There was Hulu was the pioneer in a lot of this stuff, and it did great things where it's like watch a longer ad and then you won't have any breaks during the program. Say the reason why there's this marketplace is kind of like a dumbbell. There's basically all the growth is happening in two things, either television, streaming television in particular, which we could also just call premium video, if you will, right? All the ton of growth there. And then there's a bunch of growth in social, which is mostly video too, whether it's Instagram or TikTok. And basically you've got those two worlds that are growing really well. I'd say everything else is moving towards those ends of the dumbbell or the spectrum because marketers love sight, sound, and motion to tell their stories of brand impact. And consumers love sight, sound, and motion to see stories that, that entertain them and inform them. And so it's the best alignment of what consumers and marketers want. And so you still want to do video ads as much as you can. The 30 second is not the only format that works. We see 5 second, 10 second, 60 second spots that all do very well. But you've got, sort of an agreed upon standard, and there's not that many standards we can agree on anything. So, there's a lot to be said for the benefits of standardized approaches to creating something that can be used across many different platforms. So I think the 30 and the 15 second spots are here to stay. I do think there'll be plenty of innovation around the edges, and there should be. And I wouldn't be shocked if there's some new things that we find to work really well. The one that is working best in our data, besides the standard unit, are these sponsored integrations, where there's organic product placement with the talent, with the program
itself. Is that dynamic or it actually filmed?
It's usually not dynamic. I think that's very hard. It's not impossible with AI,
right?
With the ability to render stuff in AI that is, hyper-real.
Is that far in the future still, you think? There are companies like Curve that are promoting this. Do you think they're going to actually?
I don't think it's super far. I still think human creativity matters a ton.
Right.
And human creators, when you're challenged with, okay, how do we create a great new series on Netflix or Hulu or Amazon or Peacock? How do we create a great new series, but we also can show, new Ford trucks or, this new candy from Hershey's, right? Like the humans are going to do that better than the machines for a very long time. So I do think you'll still find that the best sort of outcomes are going to be driven by that human thing, but you could do a lot of AI and enhanced human creativity where the AI is a tool that makes the humans much more productive and effective. You can imagine that where, you get like sort of a lot of variations of product placement within a program that are dynamic to who's watching or the circumstances, right? It doesn't have to be the same color iPhone that's placed in that scene in that Apple TV Plus show. It could be many different colors of that iPhone. And that, I think that is not that far away. Probably that's probably in that tarot, none of us are good at predicting the timeframes, but I wouldn't be shocked to see it in the 3 to 7 year timeframe.
Identity resolutions, obviously what everyone's talking about, sounds fancy, but why should Joe advertiser care in plain speak?
Oh, I think it's It's really important that they care. I think a lot of this industrial complex is predicated on user data, but there's a lot of studies. This is not EDO's sort of data. This is people like Truthset, which is a really interesting company. And Truthset has done some studies where they bump up data you can buy from, you know, the various programmatic exchanges or whatever, data that's purports to be about consumers, and then they bump it up against sources of truth. And, you know, you're seeing accuracy rates where less than half of that data is accurate when they do those kind of tests.
Right.
So a lot of that inaccuracy stems from the uncertainty of true identity. Part of that is driven by just technical limitations. Part of it's driven by the very deliberate changes that people like Apple and others have implemented in their platforms. And then there's regulation, right? I mean, there's a lot of stuff where privacy regulation prevents, you know, sort of a real close look at what true identity is. And I think the really important thing is to live with that uncertainty, but don't put all your eggs in the basket of audience data where you expect it to be perfect, because it's not. And it's
what was the biggest nut for you to crack
when it comes to identity?
Yeah,
for us, it's we're such a scaled automated system that identity, if you do it wrong, it drives a lot of cost, and that becomes it just breaks these automated scaled systems for on a business model level. So for us, it's been about driving high quality.
How do you prevent that though? How do you ensure that your identity metrics are real?
You do as much direct matching as you can. You try to avoid external taxes from identity graphs that, you know, that sort of are like toll booth operators. And you gotta be highly automated at this in a way where you are creating a real sense of what a household is. Honestly, I think households much more likely to be accurate than individuals, members of a household, because there's just too much shared devices and too many shared, you know, logins for there to be really high confidence at an individual level. So I think for a lot of these circumstances, household is where you want to focus. You have to have a high confidence view of households, and then you want to do very efficient ways of connecting those to other data sets. And I believe that a lot of that should be direct matching. Clean rooms are, I think, a good technology as long as you're working off of, you know, sort of systems that are widely adopted so that you're not driving incremental costs for people to
consume. It's forecast.
Oh, I think it's absolutely about these systems that are driving a lot of the demand and supply out there. They need to move from pretty simplistic, okay, I'll reach your audience for the minimal cost, to these always optimizing systems like Google has built, like Facebook, Meta has built. That needs to be perpetuated around the whole ecosystem. And it's going to be through people like Trade Desk and Magnite, where, you know, you're doing automatic performance maximization within a variety of constraints. It's algorithmic. AI is perfect for this. When you try to do this in spreadsheets, you know, the complexity, it's multidimensional complexity that fails, right? You can't build pivot tables that handle these many dimensions. And so you've got to make it an algorithmic, you know, optimizer. And that's not yet how DSPs and SSPs work, yet they are the backbone of a lot of the volume that flows through the system. So they've got to evolve to outcome-based optimization.
There's always something unexpected around the corner. What has recently thrown you for a loop, expected or not? And you're free to blame Mercury retrograde. And I'll pretend to understand astrology.
Oh, gosh. I mean, I just said a bunch of this in a positive way, but the reality of trying to make things interoperable we've talked about it so much, but it's been so hard.
Right.
So many of these organizations are giant, understandably bureaucratic, because they've got more to lose than to gain, you know, in this kind of privacy and security environment that we live in. So they're slow to move. It's really hard to get true interoperability between, you know, system X and system Y. Identity's a big problem, but not the only at all, right? A lot of it's just lawyers who don't have the technical understanding right. of the systems. A lot of it's risk aversion, you know, where folks that should be thinking aggressively about the future are intended to avoid it if they can and ride it out. So those are that's been Mercury's retrograde for this industry.
So what's your go-to drink? And you can't say water.
We're
all friends. You can skip green juice and all that. We're friends.
Yeah, no, I really like a Vesper martini these days. That's vodka and gin with a, you know, a touch of vermouth and a twist of lemon. It's very good. Or just a straight, you know, dirty vodka martini with some good blue cheese stuffed olives.
Mm. So what's your favorite comfort meal? And does it involve cheese, or is that just me projecting?
Oh, gosh. My favorite, my Southern California roots, my favorite comfort meal would be anything Mexican, especially, you
fish
know.
Tacos.
Yeah, especially street tacos, really of any filling. Some great homemade, you know, refritos, refried beans, and yes, a lot of melted cheese, like a really good cheese quesadilla.
Do you miss that? I mean, are you like, or has the New York food culture is a little bit different, or I would say a little bit dirtier.
New York is finally getting some real street tacos in some places. But yes, I'm fortunate enough that my wife's also from Southern California, and right. EDO has a good sized office in LA, and we make it back to LA and San Francisco, which also has great Mexican food. Make it back there often enough that I can get my fix. But I'd say if you're in Manhattan, Los Tacos does right. an authentic, solid street taco, really good flour tortillas, very fresh. So I recommend if you're around like Soho or Tribeca, Los Tacos is a recommendation.
What's a buzzword that you like to erase from the advertising industry? Personally, me, it's pivot, because I want to stop pretending we're all ballet dancers. But you know, we have synergy, leverage, disruptive, innovative.
Oh wow. It's when people claim to be building platforms that are nothing like platforms, and
all right,
and it cheapens
an AI platform. That's what I've been saying lately. Everything's AI today.
Yeah, it cheapens all the really hard to build platforms that people like us have actually spent years and many, many dollars and many, many people hours building. You know, let us build those platforms, and you do your client services. Is what I'd like to sort of cut down on, are the blurring of those lines, because it doesn't help anybody.
What happened if the internet went down permanently? How would you pivot, using that word, your advertising strategy? Smoke signals, carrier pigeons, telepathy, skywriting, because nothing says buy now like letters in the clouds.
Right. If the internet, first of all, we'd have a lot of other problems, including our kids would
kill us. I don't know what my child.
Violent revolt. But if we survive if we survive the chaos in the streets, I do think. I mean, I like, as much as I hope Elon Musk's Neuralink thing fails because of who's doing it, I do think like human computer like interaction modes do need to get. Yeah. Sort of, we do need to like stop relying entirely on our hands and our voices and start getting into that place where, you know, we
have. Do you really want your wife knowing what you're thinking?
Well, no. I think there's got to be some really clear boundaries. But
I think privacy regulations now will look like kids play.
But you know, I mean, some of our comfort would, I think, be if it wasn't purely connected to the internet, right? If it wasn't hackable. But you know, think about just for accessibility for people who aren't like great with their hands anymore, right? If they've got some obstacles to using their hands, or if they, you know, or if they, for whatever reason, can't use their voice, you know, I do think there's a lot to be said for new modes of human-computer interaction that that's what I would pivot towards, and that would still help us understand the efficacy of advertising. And by the way, the Apple, you know, the Apple sort of 3D goggles, I don't think that's the form factor, but the idea is fantastic. Like a heads-up display.
Eventually it's going to be contacts or in our own normal glasses, you know.
Exactly. Or something that's Neuralinked and, you know. Anyway.
So what gets you out of bed in the morning besides the alarm clock's relentless cruelty? Is it passion? Coffee? Or the realization you forgot to turn off your Zoom video?
It's the kids and family. It's the opportunity to like, you know, maybe just slightly over half of the time do something healthy like running or yoga, and then definitely coffee, lots of coffee. And I think you know, one of the cool things about EDO has been that realization that like I and a bunch of us, we like what we do. And if we were to do it all over again, we would choose exactly this, right? I mean, it's there's a bunch of us who've been working together for a long time, and we do it because we like serving our customers, but we also do it because we like working with each other. And I come to the office 5 days a week. It's a reasonable walk for me, which is one of the very few privileges of being CEO, is that you get to choose where the office is. But I love seeing the people in the office. I really do. And it's, you know, it's not just like old habit. It's genuinely enjoying each other's company and the chances to work together.
What's a conspiracy theory that you find secretly plausible? For example, the social media algorithms are controlled by a cattle of cats.
I feel like TikTok's algorithms are probably influenced by the Communist Party in China.
To destroy America, or just in general, just to make money?
I think it's to sow, you know, it's to sow doubt and to be a tool of influence. And right now, you know, I think it probably there's a thumb on some scale somewhere that's got people thinking about certain things. And
they point out that TikTok in China is remarkably different than it is in the United States, that they're not trying to fry the brains of their own citizens. So I think that's interesting, whether or not they're actively trying to do it. But, you know, it's hard not to think that a country with that much, with a huge intelligence service won't be doing this. What historical
conspiracy theory that like the people who design these social, these social tools and systems, they won't let their own kids use them. It tells you a lot, right?
So what's a historical figure you think would make a credible marketer in the digital age? For example, Benjamin Franklin, because early to bed would somehow sell mattresses online.
I bet Winston Churchill would do well. You know, I think he.
You must buy ads. We are going to fight ads.
He had a real knack for language. He could turn a phrase that could move a lot of people. I think he would do well. I think FDR, by the way, another contemporary, would do well. In this age.
He can sell wheelchairs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that most people aren't aware that he was in a wheelchair. Shows you how brand perception has changed.
It does, right? Yeah. And I mean, he just made it work for him.
What's the most outrageous idea you have ever pitched, and did it fly or flop?
We turned Bloomberg.com's homepage into a flat feed of stories.
Right.
to really set ourselves apart from kind of the newspaper front page that is still, and to hearken to our heritage as the Bloomberg Terminal. And it was probably a bridge too far for a lot of people.
Hey, before we go, I always ask if you could send yourself a text message into the past when you started in this industry. What's a piece of advice you tell yourself? And would you listen?
Go where the growth is the advice. It is so much easier to try things, fail, learn, iterate, improve when you've got growth as the wind at your back. A growing market, right? I mean, you can aim high. You know, there's lots of old adages, but like aim high, you miss, you're still landing in a big marketplace that's growing. The margin for error is just much higher than when you're in a shrinking marketplace or a shrinking segment of a marketplace. Everything's more painful. There's no room for error, and you don't get to try and learn. You just are constantly hunkered down and feeling beleaguered. And so, you know, I think I've listened to that sometimes, and sometimes I've forgotten it, and it makes a big difference.
And that's a wrap on today's Seismic Conversation with Kevin Krim of EBO. We've traversed the landscape of TV measurement, peeked behind the curtain of digital advertising, and emerged, dare I say, enlightened. A huge shout out to our sponsor, Troutman Amon LLP, whose support keeps us diving deep into the realms of ad tech innovation. Without them, navigating these waters would be a tad more challenging. As we close this chapter, remember the ethos that propels us forward. Stay curious, stay bold, and know more than you did yesterday.